This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And I want to introduce you to a man who we could describe as a troubadour, an activist, a folk singer. His name is Jim Page. And if you are a longtime Seattleite, which I almost am, you will know him as the reason that busking is legal outside the Pike Place Market in Seattle. Do I have that right?
You do.
Yes.
You do.
That's why musicians can play on street corners or outside the opera or outside the rep in the evening, because Jim Page went to the, what, city council, county council? What did you
do? City council.
City council. And you brought your guitar in.
Yes, I did. I wrote a song for it, and it was 1974, and that was Watergate. And that had to do with secrets, and that had to do with hidden agendas and all this kind of thing. And I was very much into free speech and people, public talking, you know. And to me, busking, and I called it street singing, but to me, street singing was always, it was public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's free speech.
Right.
Fundamental
it was free
right.
Speech. It was the news of the day, the old thing that the troubadours did, you know, throughout history.
Yeah. And you're still what, 71 now?
72.
And 72. And you're still troubadouring. And I wanted to have you on because you've released a new CD, which is called The Time Is Now. So you've got Pulling the Statues Down, which is about getting rid of the Confederate statues. You've got Amazon, about how this giant corporation changed Seattle. You're pushing a progressive agenda, it sounds like, to
me. When people ask me in interviews, sometimes people will say, why do you sing political songs? And I used to explain myself. And finally, I got to the point in my life where I just look at them and I say, why don't you?
Uh-huh. Tell me about Angeline.
Angeline is a great story. The short version is that years ago, I was sitting in the Pike Place Market, and I was sitting in that little place there by the Oyster Bar and so on, you know, and there's a tree in there. And I had a friend who was a custodian. Her name was Mary. She was born and raised in Seattle, and she saw me sitting there, and we talked, and she told me that that tree, some people call it Angeline's tree.
Angeline's tree.
Right. And I said, who's Angeline? And she told me. Angeline was Chief Seattle's daughter. And I just loved that idea, Angeline's tree, and that Angeline used to live down there. Somewhere down there, before the market even existed. And the people say sometimes they see her ghost, her spirit, walking around at night through the market. In this beautiful country in which I'm living, there is a story that you'll find about a woman named Kiki Soul Blue, and how they called her Angeline. Angeline. Angeline wasn't her name. I kind of knew it wasn't her name.
Yeah, right.
I knew that. But she was renamed by the wife of Doc Maynard, who stopped her in the street and said, you're much too beautiful for such an ugly name, as her Indian name.
What was her Indian name?
Her Indian name was Kiki So Blue.
Kiki So Blue.
That was her name, and this woman told her that that was an ugly name, and that she would be renamed as Angeline. And there are those in the world, myself included, who think that when you rename somebody, you take possession of them.
Yeah.
Anna was a fine and expensive, a wife of Doc Maynard. Who defined her into something to be owned, when she said, you're much too beautiful for such an ugly name. From now on you will be known as Angeline. Not Kiki So Blue. And they made it really good. She lived in this shack downtown, and when she was told to move, she didn't. When they made all the Indian people illegal and said they had to get out of town, she didn't. She stayed. So she stayed, and the city was built around her. And, you know, like you, I think of her when I see these people that don't move, when a freeway have to come through.
The woman in Ballard, who had the old house in Ballard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, near the Trader Joe's there. Yeah. Yeah, that sort of thing. So to me, she's like she's a symbol of resistance, of continuity, of, you know, the muscle of life. Life has a muscle. And she's a symbol of that to me. You know, because she had guts and she just kept going. She stayed. She stayed, you know, when she was told to leave.
Yeah.
So.
keep your soul blue.
Another song that I wanted to highlight. Pulling the Statues Down.
Oh, yeah.
You took on pulling down the statues of Confederate soldiers. And actually, you turned it into a pretty catchy hook, I have to say.
Yeah. Pulling the statues down. Bells ringing. Statues down. And everybody's singing, hey, you look at that. Ain't that a beautiful sight to see?
See, part of it was inspired by my friend Christy Moore in Ireland. He's a great Irish singer. Christy Moore. And he wrote a song with Bono about the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. Okay? It was a very hopeful song, very positive song. And it's called Both Sides of the River. And there's a line in there that says, some old songs aren't worth singing. Okay? And that's right. So to me, it's like, and I put that in there, some flags we don't fly anymore, some songs we don't sing anymore. And that goes for me too. You know, you grow up, you don't do that. So as a country, we need to grow up. Think about these things, and let's talk. And maybe we can all get together and take the flags down.
Sometimes what you stand up for ain't what you thought it was. There's a new day knocking on the old one's door. Can't ignore it anymore. Come on up, take a look to see the way that it's about.
That's Jim Page. His new album is called The Time Is Now, and you can find out more at jimpage.net.
That was great.
Yeah, he's
loved hearing that.
He is a longtime Seattle singer. Well, I went back in the archives. I interviewed him last in 1985.
Oh, my. Time to catch up, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and here is Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner to tell us that home prices are softening.
Isn't softening a good word? Yes, and good morning. It's that when the numbers came out, there are some interesting things about it. Certainly, if we look at pricing, sale prices are still positive year over year. In King County, it's just marginal, though. We're up by a bit more than 2%. So it wouldn't surprise me next month when we chat that it might have actually turned negative.
Really?
But that's still, it's almost an anomaly. Because if we're coming off this weird, surreal period in 2020 and 2021, mortgage rates down below 3%, these kinds of things. So it wouldn't surprise me to see that here, mainly locally. But the big thing right now is there's a lot more inventory in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the number of listings available, it's up significantly, really across the board.
And they're sitting there for a while, too, just in my own observations and my neighborhood where, you know, I just recently bought a home in the Edmonds Market and it was like, boom, off the market, my home. Other homes in that same neighborhood are now sitting there for weeks on end.
They can be, yes. Maybe that's because we saw, again, a significant spike in mortgage rates. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that, they've been coming down. In fact, this morning we're down about 5.2%. So certainly better than we'd seen. And that might be encouraging more buyers to get out there. But more importantly, now there's more choice for them. So it doesn't mean they have to look at the first house and say, I've got to make an offer on it.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
nothing else out there. So I wouldn't say that buyers are in the driver's seat yet, but more choice means that, yeah, it's calming down a bit. But we tend to look at things based upon months of inventory, as in how long it would take to sell every home that's on the market. A balanced market is about 4 months. Now, where are we today? We're about less than two, 1.5 to 2. So it's still not balanced, but we are slowly trending back that way. But I think it's also important is to look back. I like to try and look at things comparing where we are today to where we were in 2019, pre-pandemic. Because that actually gives you a better sense of reality. Listings are still lower today than they were back then. So again, not balanced, but we are getting back that way. And certainly the rabid pace of price growth that we all experienced the last couple of years, that has slowed. And that is a very good thing.
Let's bring up the recession, because even on our own station, there is conflict over whether we're in a recession or not. There's accusations the Biden administration is changing the definition of recession. I trust you, Matthew. So what's happening?
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you do. So when you think about recessions, by the classic definition that most people, say the public as well, think about it, it's two negative quarters of growth. GDP, which is the value of goods and services we create as a nation. However, recessions are technically defined by a group of old economists in D.C. called the NBER, the National Economic Research Group. And they will take anywhere from 4 months to probably 14 months to decide whether it is or not, because it's not just GDP. What we also look at, they look at a lot of other things as well. It's very hard to have a recession when you have such a tight labor market. 370,000 jobs created last month. My forecast, the numbers, is for about 250,000 jobs added to the economy. Very hard to have a real recession when you've still got such robust job growth. And also it ignores, again, I don't want to get into the weeds, gross domestic income is another part of it that analysts look at. That's positive. It's up 1.6% last quarter. So it's technically, did we have a recession actually in 2020? We did. But guess what? It lasted 2 months, March to April. So it's really, certainly most people think about it in the broader terms, and certainly politicians do as well. No, it's negative. But also we have to understand the fact that we'll see revisions to GDP as well. It may well come out that we didn't have two negative quarters. We could have had just one. It's going to take some time. The economy is slowing, but it's certainly all the numbers that I look at suggest that even if it is a recession in the broader sense of the word, it's still very, very minor. So, and we certainly expect that growth in the third quarter is going to be up by 2-2.5%. So we're going to be coming out of it. But the headline number certainly looks bad.
Yeah.
But the number that economists look at, or actually the range of numbers, it's still very uncertain as to whether we really are in one or have had
one. And if
one.
We do have a recession, if they decided, yes, we had a recession, I think, too, we're all just so damaged still from the 08-09, which was an incredibly difficult recession. And it ruined a lot of families and lives, that not all recessions are like that. So even if we do get a recession right now, it's not necessarily going to send people under.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, it was a very hard recession naturally. The recession is caused by what? By housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore it has a greater, broader impact across the economy. America's had 19 significant recessions in its history. You're going to have 19 more. Mm-hmm. Reason why that is that businesses work in a cycle. It's always going to be the ups and the downs. That's just by the very nature of it. We have very long periods of expansion back in the 1990s to shorter ones. But on average, 7 to 8, 9 years roughly between recessions. So, yeah, I mean, people, you hear the R word. Mm-hmm. It scares everyone. But again, mainly because of the housing factor, because that made it, its implications were really very broad spread. This one, I think for most people, you know, we had a recession back in 2020, mm-hmm. by definition, two negative quarters, but it was driven by one thing, COVID. Mm-hmm. We actually saw a 32% drop. I mean, the biggest drop in history in the second quarter of 2020, followed by a 36% increase the following quarter, as we were starting to think we could come out of it. So, yeah, I mean, even if it is, in all respects, technically speaking, a recession, we'll know that down the road at some point. It's something which I think really is nothing to be overly concerned about. I certainly don't see it as being systemic and carrying on for a prolonged period of time.
Isn't a recession the whole point? Hasn't the Fed been trying to do exactly that? Because you can't control inflation if people have too much money in their pockets. And a really great way to take money out of people's pockets is to get them fired.
Why do you get them fired? So when we talk about the Fed has... They have what's called a dual mandate, full employment, stable inflation. Mm-hmm. That is their only job. Now, how can they control that? And certainly on the inflation side, they can control it by raising taxes per se, not much of that, but actually raising interest rates to slow down. 70% of the U.S. economy is consumption, us buying stuff. We make it more expensive. That slows the economy down. But the Fed have a really bad track record at soft landings. They tend to do too much too late or too little, too early. And so I think for most analysts, they think, including myself, when the Fed starts getting involved again, let's be a little bit cautious, because it is very, very hard for them to do. But they will raise rates, and that will continue, although it's likely that we are seeing some softening in inflation now, believe it or not. Headline numbers still very high, X out food and energy. We've seen that drop down for the last few months. We're looking at soybean prices, wheat prices, look at gas. It's dropped down every day for the last 55 days. I mean, half of the country now is paying less than $5 a gallon. Still very expensive. But we are seeing those signs that inflation is starting to taper, which ultimately, hopefully, will lead the Fed to be more thoughtful as they raise rates, maybe not raising them as much as they had planned to do only a couple of months ago.
Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. Thank you, Matthew.
As always, a pleasure. Great talking to you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington,
And it's Friday, which means our resident historian Felix Bonnell is here for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, the story of the many Cascade Peaks that were first climbed by a prolific mountaineer and guidebook author, Felix.
Yeah, this is Fred Becky. And think about Mount Despair, Forbidden Peak, Liberty Bell. Those are evocative names, and just some of the peaks around here credited to Fred Becky as first ascents. That's where he was the first person to make it to the top and to assemble a little cairn of stones there and maybe sometimes put his name on a piece of paper and put it in a jar. Amazon says he is unofficially recognized as the all-time world record holder for the number of first ascents credited to one man. Now, Becky passed away 5 years ago at age 94, and he was climbing right to the end. He was much celebrated while he was alive. There's a loving documentary about him called Dirtbag, which is a nickname for a devoted climber. He won a number of awards and honors. By all accounts and from watching the film, he was a real character, kind of a ladies' man, apparently. He came with his parents from their native Germany to Seattle in 1925 when he was a child, and in the 30s began climbing in the Olympics and Cascades. He also learned technique from the mountaineers at that really cool artificial climbing rock at Camp Long in West Seattle, believed to be one of the first of its kind, not in the only in the U.S., but in the world, where they actually, a guy named Clark Sherman designed it to as a climbing wall like 80 years ago, way ahead of its time. Fred Becky also wrote many books about the Cascades and the Olympics that are still essential to anyone who wants to know how to climb and to learn the history and geography, too. Tor Bell is from Port Orchard. He's in his early 50s. He works for a local conservation organization. He got into climbing 30 years ago, before the internet was a thing. And Tor Bell told me that Fred Becky's three-volume Cascade Alpine Guide is a climber's Bible.
Those were the books you went to. You know, that three-volume set, you know, the ones tan for the South Cascades, you know, the green one, I think, is the Central Cascades, and the red one was the North Cascades. Those were the books. You know, all the resources we have online and apps and all the rest, those didn't exist. You dove into those books, and the guy had done so much work. This was kind of everything there was.
You know, and the guides are great for technical information about which route to take and what kind of gear to use. They're still a great resource for climbers or wannabe climbers. Now, the closest I ever get to mountaineering is climbing out of my sleeping bag to not miss breakfast. So my favorite Fred Becky book is a collection of essays he wrote. They're these well-written literary accounts of climbs that he took part in around here from the 30s to the 60s. It's called Challenge of the North Cascades from Mountaineer's Books. It's not in print anymore, but you can find it in the library or secondhand. It has these gripping stories about climbing particular peaks. It's fun looking up mountain climbing vocabulary like couloir, which I learned is a steep, narrow gully on a mountainside. Why couldn't they just say a steep, narrow gully? It's couloir. Yeah, couloir. Yeah, exactly. Also has these great colorful anecdotes about Fred and his brother Helmy and the hitchhiking they did from Seattle to the Cascades. And they had to do these long, you know, tens of like 10, 20-mile hikes just to get to the base of the mountains because the North Cascades Highway hadn't been built yet. And they would routinely hike from Stehekin to Marble Mount because there was no road. And anyway, it's one of my favorite non-traditional books about local history. It's called Challenge of the North Cascades. Now, it's not in the Cascades, but there is a peak named after Fred. It's called Mount Becky. It's in the interior of Alaska, and he climbed it back in 1996. So a real local legend who left a great legacy.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and joining us is the host of Face the Nation, CBS's Margaret Brennan. Margaret, missiles flying over Taiwan, ships circling Taiwan. Was Nancy Pelosi's trip a mistake? Are we headed for some sort of confrontation? What do you think?
Well, you had overnight the White House acknowledge that they summoned China's ambassador to the United States to the White House to call him onto the carpet and press him on this escalation. You also have the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, calling this a serious overreaction to a peaceful visit by the Speaker of the House to the self-governing island of Taiwan. This is a sensitive moment. You have the U.S. also calling off some military exercises to try to send signals that America is not looking for a conflict, particularly in the Pacific right now. But China's ambassador issued a public statement overnight in the Washington Post saying this is the one issue that the United States and China could come into conflict on, Taiwan. This is touching a nerve for President Xi Jinping, who is setting himself up to seek a third term as leader of China. And this is something that the United States is sensitive about. We know prior to Speaker Pelosi's trip, she was counseled on the risks, and President Biden publicly suggested there were some serious doubts about whether it was advisable.
This is what I don't get. Taiwan is profitable the way it's currently organized, Taiwan is profitable for China, right? What would they gain by attacking it?
Taiwan is independent and democratic, but the People's Republic of China views it as a part of their overall sort of destiny in terms of reunifying them. They are self-governing. China doesn't see the benefit from that in the way that, for example, they have control right now over Hong Kong. There's a lot of speculation as to how a potential seizure of the island could play out, whether it was by overt military force or coercion and influence. So that is something that in the national security world, there has been a lot of concern about for years. But it is now appearing to be much more of a priority for Xi Jinping than thought previously.
Okay, let's talk about the election. You're going to be talking with Representative Peter Mayer of Michigan on Face the Nation. This is an unusual race. This was the one of the Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, and yet the Democrats supported his primary opponent, condemned for that. He's now lost his race. Explain that whole situation, because it may have backfired, according to the New York Times and USA Today.
Well, you know, Peter Mayer is an interesting case. He's a Michigan Republican who lost his primary, as you just said, to someone who was running to his right and endorsed by the former president, Donald Trump. Congressman Mayer had a target on his back by the president because he voted to impeach him. And because he has been outspoken about the former president's role in stoking the violence of January 6th. And so because of that impeachment vote, the former president sought him out to defeat him. Going into these primaries, as you look at which candidates will face off in November, right? The primaries are when the parties pick who represents them in that race. The Democratic strategy in some places, both at the state and at the congressional levels, some Democrats have helped to fund those more extreme candidates, the more conservative ones who are more pro-Trump, in this sort of cynical calculation that that will ultimately dissuade Republicans from coming out. Mm-hmm. It's a bet being placed on the idea that the majority of independents and the majority of Republicans are not comfortable with the direction of that party and that they might stay home if it's the more extreme candidate on the ballot versus a Democrat, thus boosting Democrats' chances of winning. It's a cynical calculation. It's some that, as you just said, some critics say could backfire, because once you put someone on a ballot, they have a chance of winning.
That's right.
And that's it. That's the risk there.
Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation. Seattle's Morning News. South King County mayors say their communities are fed up with rising crime in recent months. They are uniting to call on county leaders and state leaders to do something about it. Let's go live now to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, it's not the first time we've heard from some of these mayors, but there's more of them signed on to this statement. And Auburn Mayor, there she is. That's Auburn Mayor Nancy Backus. She's one of over a half dozen mayors to sign on to this statement, if you will, is what they're calling
it. The increase in crime that we've all seen in our communities and the significant increase in shots fired and homicides and injuries. It's like enough is enough.
Also signing the statement with her were the mayors of Black Diamond, Enumclaw, Federal Way, Pacific, Renton, Tukwila, and Kent Mayor Dana Ralph.
We're seeing increases in all levels of crime, from property crime to shots fired and homicide. Things are increasing across South County, across the region.
Now, the mayors say that the perception is that there are no consequences and no accountability for violent crime, robberies, property crimes, and drug use that has led a fearful community to start taking matters into its own hands.
Vigilantism is on its way. I mean, one of the homicides that occurred this week in the city of Auburn was an armed robbery in process at a Shell station, and the clerk was also carrying, and so the person who was trying to do the armed robbery ended up being shot and stumbled out into the parking lot and passed away. So we don't want it to get any more dangerous.
Now, in their statement, they point to a variety of recent events that they say has coincided with this crime. That includes the state Supreme Court's Blake decision, which, of course, did away with our state's felony drug possession law. They also point to recently passed police reform bills, specifically the police vehicular pursuit legislation that basically bars cops from doing much as far as chases go these days. They also are talking about the influx in more addictive methamphetamine and fentanyl that is contributing to the mental health crisis, as well as an increase in property crimes and deadly overdoses. They point to the King County jail, that the jail in Kent, police have not been able to transfer people into lockup up there for several months now, and the one night recently that the King County Jail in Seattle was not able to take any prisoners on a Sunday night because of a lack of staffing. They say that's a problem. They say both felony adult and felony juvenile prosecutions take too long. There's not enough resources. So they're basically critical of everything from the state legislative level to the prosecutor level. And Mayor Dana Ralph from Kent says this is really a system-wide problem. This was a response when I asked. I said, you know, we do that regular segment with Casey McNerney from the prosecutor's office every Monday. And what we often find is that even with the prosecutors being very aggressive in certain cases, judges let people out either with low bail or no bail, and then they reoffend. I said, what about the judges? And here was what her answer was.
We know that every level of the justice system has to be working together in order for it to be effective. So our police officers need to be able to do their jobs and do them. The detention system has to work. The prosecutor system has to be there, and the judges have to be there at the same time. And so what we're seeing is failure in all different parts of the system. And so it doesn't work. Our police officers can be doing everything they can. And if there's laws preventing them from proactively fighting crime, it doesn't work. If we can't keep the offenders in custody long enough to get them through the process, it doesn't work. So yeah, those gaps are definitely what has gotten us to this point.
And basically they're saying that.
Okay, Hannah, we know that this is a problem. They've been complaining about
exactly.
It. So do they just complain about it, or do they have some ideas on what to do? Because if the judges, okay, I mean, you and I have talked about these the judges letting them off early, but if you're telling me now there's no staffing to even book them into the jail, what's the point of sending them to jail? They're not going to go to jail.
Well, right. So that's part of what they're calling for here. They're calling on the state legislators and the county executive, the King County Council, to take some action and understand and hear the public and the frustrations that they have here. They talk about the jail. So, okay. In fact, they talk about they don't necessarily think everybody needs to be locked up. They definitely believe in the restorative justice programs and all of that. But certain people do need to be locked up, and they point to one of our state lawmakers who was herself locked up for some time because of drug issues, mm-hmm. who then got her law degree and became a successful state lawmaker and has been very active in the last couple of years. They say so that is good evidence that there is room to do something in lockup for those people who do have to go to jail, but there needs to be investment there, right? Because that's not mm-hmm. what's happening.
So they're
right
saying now. They want actual rehab programs for people who are locked.
Yes, absolutely. So why not fix the jail system? I think is exactly what Mayor Bacco said to me when we were talking about that. The other thing, and because that what you're saying to me, Dave, right now is what I said to them. I said, I've heard all of this before. I've heard it from you guys before, and what are you going to do? I mean, there's all kinds of different levels of government involved here. There's not a lot of appetite to do anything more about locking more people up. What is it that you think needs to happen? And it has to do with the public. They need to hear more.
I truly believe that the people that we represent in each of our very diverse communities, most of them live in the middle, right? They're not extremes on the left or to the right. They live in the middle. They're good, hardworking people trying to take care of their families, trying to provide and have maybe a couple of nice things. And right now, their rights don't seem to be as important as the rights of those who are offending, who are stealing, who are breaking windows, who are shooting up or smoking the blues out. I mean, I've seen them smoking and shooting up right outside my window. And there's not a darn thing that a police officer can do about that except go up and say, hey, would you like resources? And can you tell me your name? And if they don't want to tell their name, you can't necessarily make that one of the documented interactions where you have offered resources before you can do something.
Yeah. See, she's put her finger on the problem. Mm-hmm. The people are fed up. They're sympathetic. They understand that there are problems that social problems that they can't control. But that doesn't mean they're going to tolerate, as you put it, the broken windows and the drugs on the streets. So this requires the legislature to act, right? And is there any pressure? I assume legislators are in some of their summer meetings now to propose something.
Yeah. Some of those summer meetings are making changes to our sentencing program, right, with our mm-hmm. offender score and all of that. And those will lean towards not locking as many people up or locking them up for less time. There's still going to be, and especially given the shape
so
of
they're
going to
go
the
softer.
Election results
what's,
right now.
What's wrong with the idea of taking, if you have somebody who is doing drugs on the street and they do it again and again and they're burglarizing people to supply their habit, they are taken straight to a locked rehab facility. What's the problem with doing that?
The problem with doing that is that we don't have enough of those right now.
All right.
That's
why don't
problem.
We have enough
have
of them?
To.
I remember Randy Revelle?
Yes.
King, okay. He was big on the whole mental health thing. That was, what, 30 years ago?
It's been a minute. Yes. Okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so who is standing in the way, I guess, is the only thing we can ask at this point. Who
politics.
Is standing?
This is politics standing in the way. So we've got decades. As I got a statement in reaction to this from King County Executive's Chief of Staff, who says that there's part of this issue is that every level of government has a role to play. And he points to decades of an underfunded behavioral health system. That is part of the problem. So we don't have all of the facilities that we need. There is an effort to have more. There will be more coming online. There is actually a bill that passed the last session that does allow for forced treatment to a certain degree. But again, mm-hmm. we've got to have those facilities in the community where the offenders are to get that going. And it's going to be a minute before we get that up to scale. That is in the works. It needs to be at a much larger level. You need to see more investment. That is going to be the result of pressure on our state lawmakers. I think that this is such a complicated issue and that not everybody understands the ins and outs and where to actually apply their public voice and that pressure. And that is what these mayors are saying. Mm. They're begging for the public to get loud and make that pressure on all of our levels of government so that people act.
Oh, getting loud. That shouldn't be a problem these days. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Let's get to your daily dose of kindness sponsored by Heritage Homecraft before this goes any further off the rails. Mothers will do anything for their children. And in Gilbert, Arizona, that generosity goes both ways. Melanie Shaha, she's battled a benign brain tumor for nearly 2 decades.
I have had a recurrent benign brain tumor, a pituitary tumor. And I've had surgery twice, in 2003 and in 2006. I was very surprised when my tumor returned in 2017. And I had radiation. And radiation took my hair. So I have not had any hair since Valentine's Day of 2018.
The loss of hair is a tough blow to those undergoing treatment, like salt in a wound.
I don't mind being sick, but I do mind looking sick.
That's when the support of family and friends can change the game. For Melanie, her oldest son turned out to be her biggest supporter.
I have a newfound respect for women and their long hair and all of the hard work that it is.
And that's because about 2 years ago, he started growing out his own hair so that mom could have a wig like no other.
She gave it to me. So it's a no-brainer to give it back.
It's such gorgeous hair. Well, clearly, beautiful hair.
And it is. She finally got that wig flanked by her son with his freshly shorn hair. Her smile could not be bigger.
And to be such a gift of love. To feel like I look beautiful, like it's really great.
Really sweet. Also a great reason to have kids, too. You never know when you might need some extra hair.
7:48, and now here he is, a ray of sunshine, wearing his special yellow daisy shirt. G. Scott, the G. and Ursula Show.
So good.
Give us your take on the Blue Angels.
Overrated.
Which I heard yesterday.
Absolutely overrated.
Did you get any pushback for that?
I mean, I got a few folks that, you know, they were kind of mad at me. But then I also had some folks text in and said, you know what, G, you're right. You know, it's interesting. It's like, oh, let's just shut down downtown. And like my man Chris Martin said yesterday, let's shut down downtown and have tanks roll through the street, right? Like, that's what it basically is. Just like, oh, Well, hey, that's all the good. Air. You know what I mean?
They tear up the pavement. The Blue Angels don't tear up.
Yeah, and then it costs a lot of money. And then it's the same folks like, gee, where will the money come from to help people that are struggling? Where will the money come from? You ever notice that when people don't like something that's going to happen, like they don't want to give money to this, they always say, where will the money come from?
Yeah.
But they never question when you spend all that money for military and stuff. There's like, that's an open checkbook.
What about as a recruiting tool? Military is having trouble recruiting.
I mean, don't they recruit enough at halftime at the NFL games or before the games when they put the flag out there? You know, all the money that they pay the NFL for recruit up.
And all the money they promise our veterans and all the money they promise our kids.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that they put more money in recruiting and promoting than actually giving to the men and women that fought for our country?
And this is coming from somebody with multiple veterans in her family, including her sister and all of that. But they sure don't make it easy.
It's almost as if it's performative. But anyway, let's go back to Blue Thunder. I mean, not Blue Thunder. That's shout different. Out to Blue Thunder. This is Blue Angels. It's overrated, and I know Sully is steaming right now. He
better
is
believe
steaming
I am.
Right now.
You better
he,
believe
he,
I
he
am.
Wants to say America so bad.
No, what I want to say is we spend so much money on our defense budget, I just would like to see it in action. We spend so much money, and of course the F/A-18 Super Hornet, you know, has ties to Boeing, obviously. So, I mean, I want to see my tax dollars. I mean, I thank God I've never had to go to a war zone and see it for real, but I want to see my tax dollars at work.
I don't think our soldiers are doing loop-de-loops and stuff.
Well, right? But like, they can, and this is also training.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I want to see my tax dollars at work.
Cool.
And if I can blow out my eardrums while I'm doing it, heck yeah. I love
it. What about
it.
You, Dave? You haven't waited. You've been coy over there.
I don't know. I think people who are able to stand for 3 hours at a Seahawks game with all that shouting going on can't really complain about the Blue Angels.
And I don't do that either.
You don't do that either.
No. You see, hey, I have a recording of me during the Seahawks games. You don't see me standing up there doing that.
The thing is, I like the quirkiness of Seattle. And this is one of those things. It was a complete revelation to me when I first moved here, 44 years ago, that a whole city would turn out to do this. And it's sort of, you know, it's not the big thing that it was when I first got here. I don't think the Pirates invade West Seattle anymore. Maybe they
got
do.
Caught kissing people, so they
yeah,
can't.
Yeah, right. But they drive down the street, these little clown cars and stuff, and then the Angels are Blue Angels. Right? There was nothing like that in my humdrum suburban New York existence.
You know who I still want to see? The Keystone Cops. Those are still good
guys. The Keystone
guys,
Cops.
Yeah? You remember those?
No.
The parade? No, they used to walk around.
Is that who they were?
That was the coveted pin to get when you were part of parade royalty.
So when's the last time that you guys set out the family and went to go see Blue Angels?
Never. I hate crowds.
Oh,
a couple
bam!
Years ago.
Okay. You helped me out. How about you, Dave Ross?
Once.
In 44 years.
That's exactly right.
So hold on.
A couple years.
It's different because they fly right over my house.
Exactly.
So the show comes to me.
Oh.
Yeah. Actually, they top my trees.
They shake all the branches loose.
Is Mercer Island okay when that happens? Because they don't want any shake up right
there.
They
just turn down their hearing aids. That's fine.
Thank you very much.
Lois, there's rumbling in Mercer Island.
It's all right. Turn up the TV.
That's Ballard.
That's Edmonds. Oh. It's everywhere.
Edmonds. Yeah, I forgot you're an Edmonds resident there.
Yes.
$1 million home.
It's very
moving
quiet.
On,
it's
moving
very
on
quiet.
Up to the big
yeah. Clients. You live next to George Weezy?
Who?
George Weezy.
Oh, wow. Come on.
She doesn't know that show.
She doesn't know who. Oh, did I get. Sully, you know. Sully,
man.
No. Go ahead, Sully. Tell her who George is.
To Edmonds.
To that deluxe apartment in the sky.
Oh,
I finally got a piece of the pie. All right.
I was more of a Family Matters kid, but that's just.
Wow.
That one I don't know.
See you guys.
Circle.
G. Scott.
Did I do that? You know that
oh,
one.
Oh, very good.
Wow.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.